care, weaned minor injuries that are urgent but not life, limb or sight threatening. So it's things like ear infections and throat infections, sprained ankles. It includes both physical and mental health conditions, but it is not things that you need an immediate or very urgent same day within the same couple of hours response to. We're talking about conditions where you need to be seen ideally within the same day or next day, but it's not something that's going to immediately threaten your life, a limb or your sight. So why do we need to make the changes in Sheffield? We face several major challenges within Sheffield to ensure that we can provide the services that people need. We have got a reducing number of healthcare professionals for a variety of reasons, but this is particularly affecting general practices over the next 5 years. It's a national issue, so I don't know whether some of you will have heard the news over the last couple of days in terms of feedback from the BMA survey, that about one third of GP partners across the country are saying that they're unable to fulfil their vacancies that they've had over the last 12 months. But in Sheffield, we know that within the next 5 years, we are going to have shortages of GPs, of practice nurses, and of practice managers. So we know that carrying on exactly as we are is not going to be sustainable for Sheffield. We also know that, like across the rest of the country, we've got growing demand for our services, and we've got an ageing population that has more complex needs than we've ever had in the past. So because people are living longer, they're living longer with more serious conditions than they've done in the past, and that takes more services and more time for them to be supported and managed. We've spoken to thousands of Sheffield residents over the last 2 years about urgent care and specifically urgent primary care to understand what you think the issues are and the problems that we've got. And the overriding messages that have come back from everybody that we've spoken to are we need to make it far simpler for you to get the care that you need as quickly as possible. As I said, I live in Sheffield, and there are occasions when me and my family have needed urgent care in the last 2 years, and I've had to really sit and think about where I should go based on the needs of, and my husband was the last incident that we needed. I work in the area, and if I'm finding it confusing and having to sit and think about where's the best place to go, it must be even harder if you have no knowledge of the system. We know that in lots of areas of the city, access to GP appointments on the same day is really, really difficult. We know that there are some areas that are doing it really well, and no doubt that some of you will have examples in this room of brilliant practices where you can ring up and pretty much be guaranteed an appointment on the same day. But across the city, that is really difficult. It's difficult to get through on the phone in the first place, and if and when you can get through on the phone, there's often no appointments left that day. People have also told us, and this is a consistent theme with every consultation that we do with the population of Sheffield, that you want us to make as much care as possible closer to your homes so that you're not having to travel across the city. The providers have told us...
Okay, bell,
it did indeed. Right, well, we'll come on to that a bit later. Providers have also told us that we need to make sure that we use the services and the staff that we've got working within the city as effectively as we possibly can. And we don't think that we're doing that as well as we could at the moment. So, in terms of what we're proposing, there's four main changes. The first one is to improve the way people actually access the services in the first place. So I've talked about the fact that often it's difficult to get through to your GP practice, and actually because there are a number of different services in the city, and because sometimes that access to a GP practice is difficult, people are choosing or are being directed to go to other services within the city. In the new world, we are proposing that the majority of patients would either contact their GP practice and actually be able to get through, so not like it is now, or they would contact 111 and have a conversation. The majority of those conversations will be with a clinician. So again, that's very different to 111 now. And there is a national proposal to change the way that 111 works. So there's far more clinicians, so doctors and nurses and pharmacists and other groups of health professionals working at 111 to answer the telephone calls. But regardless of whether you ring 111 or you contact your GP practice in whatever way, you will have a conversation. The purpose of that conversation is to determine where is the best place for your needs to be met and who is the best clinician to meet those needs. They'll also determine whether you need to see a member of the practice team that you know because you need continuity of care, or whether that is less important. If you need signposting to another service or you need some advice on self-caring, then you will get that. But if you need to be seen that day, you will be offered an appointment time, and confirmation of where that's going to be. So you know where, who, and when you're going to be seen. So the biggest change, I think, is the second one. And I think that's going to affect the majority of the population in Sheffield. And that is about changing where you might get your GP appointment. So if you need to be seen on the day, if you need to be seen by somebody that you know, you will be offered an appointment within your GP practice. However, for the majority of patients, we don't think that's clinically necessary. And therefore, you will be offered an appointment if you have a minor illness need within a group of local GP practices. So that might mean that you're seen in your own practice, but it also might mean that you're offered an appointment within the local area. It might mean that you're seen by a GP. It could be your own GP. It could be a different GP. But it could also mean that you're seen by a different professional. Because what we're really clear about in Sheffield is that not everybody needs to see a GP. We know we're not going to have enough GPs in the future to treat everybody that needs care. And we know that there are groups of other healthcare professionals that can treat some patients far more appropriately. So that is a combination of mental health practitioners, pharmacists that can prescribe. So at the moment, we don't have many of those in the city actually prescribing. But there is, of course, and in other areas of the country, pharmacists are prescribing. So for simple things like patients with urinary tract infections, water infections, actually a lot of the time, you just need a test and some antibiotics. And that, it doesn't need to be a doctor that sees you to provide that every time. We also need to make far better use of the nursing staff that we've got across the city. And there are other health professionals that we think we can bring into the team. So you would be seen in your local area by a clinician who's overseen by a GP, but it wouldn't necessarily be a GP. We're also proposing to replace the minor injuries unit and the walk-in centre with urgent treatment centres. And I'll come on to that in a minute in terms of what the options for those are. And we're proposing to change where patients go for urgent eye care. So at the moment, patients who have an urgent eye condition, some may try to access their GP, some may go to a local optician on the high street, lots of patients go to the emergency eye clinic out of the Hallamshire. That emergency eye clinic was originally designed to see patients with sight-threatening eye conditions. And at the moment, they're telling us about half of the patients that they see have urgent eye conditions. They're not sight-threatening. So we are proposing for those patients that have urgent conditions, so when you need to be seen within 24 hours, but your condition isn't going to threaten your sight, bringing those services out into the community with an extended range of opening time. So a longer opening time than the current eye emergency service provides, closer to your own home, but with a similar level of qualified staff so that the quality of the service is no different. We are not making any cuts or reducing emergency services. within the city. We're not making any changes to planned GP appointments, other than hopefully by the way we're proposing to do this, it should reduce the waiting times in some practices for the length of time you have to wait when you need a booked appointment in advance. We are not proposing to close the emergency eye clinic. Really early on in the consultation, there was a report in the press that said that we were going to do that, and that was an error. So the emergency eye, patients with emergency conditions will continue to go to the Hallamshire. We're not proposing to make any changes this winter to any of these services. And the one thing that I haven't put on there, kind of deliberately, because from our perspective, it's not important, but for some of you, it might answer some of your questions. We are not proposing to take any money out of the urgent care system in Sheffield. So this is not about saving money. It's about spending the money that we do currently spend as efficiently and as effectively as we possibly can. So it does mean that we're moving money around the services within the city, but not taking money out. So, in terms of the three options, our preferred option is option one, for those of you who have seen the consultation document. And that is basically that if you're an adult, so if you're over 16, you would go to the urgent treatment centre if you don't want to be seen in your local GP area of practices, if you need minor illness, or if you need minor injury. So the urgent treatment centre at the Northern would do both. But the expectation is, because we are improving access to GP practice appointments, actually the majority of patients who have a minor illness condition will choose to be seen in their local area and will not want to travel and will not need to travel across the city to the Northern General Urgent Treatment Centre. Under option one, if you're a child or you're caring for somebody who's under the age of 16, those children would go to the children's hospital. If they've got a minor injury, they would be seen within the children's emergency department, which is what happens now. And if they've got a minor illness condition, and again, for whatever reason, you don't want to be seen in your local area, then you would be seen at an urgent treatment centre sited on the children's hospital site. With option two, the difference there is that both adults and children with minor illness would go to the Northern General. So the only people that wouldn't go to the Northern General would be children with a minor injury, and they would continue to go to the emergency department at the Children's Hospital as they do now. And option three is very similar to option one. The difference there is that adults, if you've got minor injury, you would be seen at the Northern General emergency department. So the urgent treatment centre at the Northern General would just see the illness for adults. So from some of the previous meetings that we've held, we've been asked how doable we think the getting the GPs to work together is. And there's been questions about actually practically, it might sound like a good idea, but actually can we do it? So we wanted to reassure you, GPs are already starting to work together across the city. We've currently got the GPs working in 16 groups. And this is not just something that we're doing locally, this is happening across the country. We think that the GPs working together in groups will help to address the future staffing shortages that we know that we are facing, as well as, you know, it's a national shortage. And that is partly why it's a national direction of travel. We believe that it will help us to manage the increase in demand and the increase in complexity for patients. Because by working together, not only does it increase the resilience of the practices because there's a bigger group of staff caring for some of the patients, but it also in some areas makes employing additional staff far more viable. So if you've got, for example, a physio, and you can employ them across four or six practices, that's far easier and far more sense to do that and use one physio, whereas at the moment one practice might only need a physio half a day a week. And trying to employ a member of staff half a day a week is actually really hard, whereas if you bring them all together, you might be able to employ a full-time person and use the skills of that person far more effectively. We have already got examples of where the practices working together
are meeting the needs of specific groups of patients. We have got an example of where some practices have kind of identified that in their local area they've got a particularly high incidence of diabetes. And by working collectively together, they've bought additional equipment and kit, and they've employed us. They've brought, been able to bring a specialist out of the hospital to run clinics across the group of practices for patients with diabetes. And that's not something that an individual practice by themselves would be able to manage. We think that the work that's already happening on neighbourhood, on we call them neighbourhoods, means that it'll help us to manage urgent care demand better. So this is something that's happening regardless of what we're proposing to do with urgent care. We've been talking about it for probably 18 months, 2 years. But we recognise that from an urgent care perspective, it is going to take more time to develop. And that's why we have planned kind of a 2-year timescale to get up to full implementation. Because we think that we need a local solution for each group of GP practices so that it can meet the needs of those specific groups of patients. So we've also been asked, why do we need urgent treatment centres? What is the point of kind of closing the minor injuries unit and the walk-in centre and combining them into one? We believe that it's simpler for patients to understand. If you have got a urgent treatment centre or at least a site that can treat both minor injuries and minor illness, you as individual patients and the clinicians that work in the system that will help you navigate to the right place, it makes it far easier for them. Urgent treatment centres can access your, or will be able to access your clinical record. At the moment, the walk-in centre and the minor injuries unit can't do that. But when you go to the urgent treatment centre, if you give consent, because you as an individual patient have to agree that people can access your clinical record, they will be able to see that information in the same way that if you go to your GP practice or your local group of practices, they will be able to see that information. If we move to urgent treatment centres, we'll be able to provide additional diagnostic examinations that we don't currently have, particularly at the walk-in centre. So things like x-rays, blood tests, ECGs. That increases the chance of you as an individual patient having a diagnosis and treatment in the at the same point, rather than at the moment you have to potentially go from one place to another place to get some of those diagnostic tests. We also think that it enables us to use staff that we've currently got within the system far more effectively. And as we said, we've already got a staffing issue that we know that we need to face in the future, and we think this will help us do that. So I think there was, fair to say, a bit of challenge in the room earlier when we talked about the urgent treatment centre and why we think it should go to the Northern. So again, that's something that we have heard loud and clear, that people are not convinced, don't understand why we've chosen to site it at the Northern as opposed to in the city centre. So just to put it into a bit of context, at the moment, about 60,000 patients go to the walk-in centre each year. About 18,000 patients go to the minor injuries unit. And we know that some of the patients that are using the minor injuries unit are using it for minor illness conditions, which is not what it's designed to do. Across GP practices, we think there's approximately 600,000 same-day urgent appointments provided by all the GP practices in the city. So that gives you a bit of an idea about the kind of the volume of the scale of what we're trying to do. So in terms of the amount of patients that will go into the urgent treatment centres in the future, it'll be a proportion of that 60,000 and a proportion of the 18,000. But actually, from what you're telling us so far in the feedback from the consultation, at the moment, 72% of people that have answered the questionnaire in the back of the consultation are telling us if they've got a minor illness condition, they want to be seen in their local area. They don't want to have to travel across the city to an urgent treatment centre, wherever that urgent treatment centre is. So that was part of our thinking when we were working out where to site the urgent treatment centres and what the proposals would be. But some of the other aspects of our thinking were that obviously if you go to somewhere for urgent care, and actually what you need is emergency care, because there are occasions when your condition is more serious than it first turns out to be. If we cite the urgent treatment centre at the Northern, and if we cite the children's one at the Children's Hospital, you are in the right place if your condition is more serious than is first thought. It supports GP waits, because there are always going to be some patients that are going to continue to try and access the emergency department at either hospital site when actually they've got minor illness conditions. By citing the urgent treatment centres at the Northern and at the Children's, it's far easier to divert those patients that do not have emergency needs into the appropriate treatment facility, which would be the urgent treatment centres. It also means that there is far more potential for joined up working between the urgent treatment centre staff and the staff that we've got based at both hospitals. And if you bring those services out, if you bring the urgent treatment centre out to anywhere in the city centre, that makes that far more difficult. So, it makes the ability for staff to work across services and learn from each other far more difficult if it's in the centre.
We'll take questions afterwards, but fair enough.
So, in terms of how it might look like in the future, last year my daughter developed infected eczema, what I thought was infected eczema, and actually it turned out to be. We were on holiday when the spots first appeared, and by the next day we were travelling back, and we were really concerned because it was the second time it had happened. And so literally as soon as we got home, we decided that we needed to speak to a clinician in primary care to work out what the best step was. So by the time we got home, got indoors, rang the practice, it was 1:50 in the afternoon. I was on hold for 15 minutes because of the way our practice system works. And when I finally got through to the receptionist to ask to speak to our triage nurse, because that's the way our practice does it, I was told that the triage nurse clinic had ended at 2:00. And I'd been on hold since 10 to 2. So I said, well, what can I do then? I just need to speak to a clinician. The advice I was given was either to ring back tomorrow at 8:00, or rather try to ring back tomorrow at 8:00, or to go to the walk-in centre in town. Now, I don't know whether any of you have had a similar experience, but I felt extremely frustrated by that. All I was asking for was to speak to a clinician. I wasn't asking to be seen. I was just asking for a conversation. So in the future, and we know that this happens in some practices across the city now, I will be able to ring up my practice in that scenario, speak to somebody straight away who can advise me of the right action to take. And if I need an appointment, they will be able to book an appointment for me within 24 hours and in the main within the same day. I will be seen by the most appropriate clinician to treat my needs. That might not be a GP. And if necessary, if my condition or the person that I'm caring for, if their condition changes, for some patients we believe it would be appropriate for somebody to ring the patient or the carer back a couple of hours later and just check whether the condition has changed. And again, in some practices this is already happening and we know that it works really well. But these changes are about making sure that everybody in the city receives the same level of access and the same level of service. So, in summary, we think that by having that initial conversation, whether that's with somebody in your practice or through 111, that it will be a less confusing system because you will be signposted to the most appropriate service. You are not having to try and work out which service to go to, whether they're open, where they are, whether it's the right service. Somebody will tell you where to go, when to go, and who to be seen by. You have told us that access to GP appointments is really difficult across the city. And we think that by these proposals, by the practices working together in groups, that we can ensure that patients will be offered an urgent appointment within 24 hours, and for most patients it'll be within the same day, when they need it. We also think that by enabling that to happen, and through the changes that we're proposing with the emergency eye clinic access for those with urgent eye care, that fewer people will have to travel out of their local area and travel across the city. So, the consultation process. Mandy's already referenced the fact that we've chosen to extend the consultation to ensure that as many people as possible can get involved and can feed their back their views. And we've also heard from several people that we haven't provided enough information about the detail of some of our proposals. Hopefully some of that we've picked up in the presentation today, and no doubt we'll have another, you know, you'll have lots of questions in a minute that we can address. But we're also planning on releasing quite a lot of information next week. And we were conscious that if we released that and kept the consultation date end date as it was, that would give you very limited time to digest that and respond to us and us to have further conversations with you. So the consultation will now end on the 31st of January. But some of the things that we've already heard so far, concerns about travelling and particularly parking at the Northern General. We recognise, you know, we all have to go to the Northern General regularly and completely empathise with the parking issues. We think, and the general feedback that we're getting from patients at the moment through the questionnaire, is that most people want to be seen in their local area. So we don't think that's as big a problem as people generally think it might be. But we do recognise that any additional cars going onto the Northern General site will make it even harder than it already is. So we need to think about how we would manage that. We've had quite positive feedback about providing urgent care closer to people's homes. And as I said, lots of people have said, actually, if it meant that they could be seen within 24 hours and mostly the same day, then people are generally happy to be seen in their local area rather than necessarily at their own GP practice. So that's the end of the presentation. And Mandy's going to manage the conversations we now have.
I have to say it was the first thought I had when I woke up this morning that I would be having to field the questions today. Thanks, Kate. That was really helpful, I hope, for colleagues and people here. We've already had one question asked. Yes. I was just about to say it wasn't raised as a question, but I've noted it as a question because it was around the relationship with having a city centre service and the connections with the hospital. So we'll come up. Yes, and I appreciate it wasn't quite caught, but I think it's worth noting that. When people ask questions, we're going to ask you to hold a mic so that we can properly pick it up in the recording, if that's okay. So do people want to put their hands up if they've got any questions to ask? And I will try to capture everybody. So we'll start at the front.
Thank you very much. This has been really helpful, actually, to understand some of the reasoning behind it. My question is, when you're talking about, and I understand this has been a concern people already raised, but having some clarification would be helpful. When you're talking about the location of the urgent care centre in the Northern General as opposed to the Royal Hallamshire Hospital, and you say how you hope that most patients would rather go to a GP practice, for instance, for urgent care, but then you say, we're locating the service in Northern General in case it turns out to be more serious than anticipated. How would you avoid this issue if people are getting urgent care at GP practices and it turns out that they need more, you know, serious care?
I'm going to ask Anthony to answer that.
Is this mic working? Yes. if you think about how most people access their GP practice, there are occasional exceptions to this where people in certain areas of the city lack English as a first language and lack access to good telephony. Those practices tend to offer sort of drop-in type services and things like that. But outside of that, the vast majority of us access our GP services by ringing. So in the future, what we're talking about is much more what we call care navigation at the front end. So if you're ringing with something that actually should be going somewhere else, for example, an optometrist or a dentist or whatever it may be, or community support workers, social prescribing type stuff, that you'll be directed elsewhere appropriately. And then the next level beyond that is clinical triage. And many people in the room will be used to this. You ring your doctor for surgery, and then you either get put through to a doctor or to a nurse practitioner, or they ring you back. And they're basically assessing the nature and urgency of the problem. And actually, if what you describe to them is something that actually sounds really quite worrying, actually it may be that the most appropriate place for you to go is the Northern General Emergency Department. And that will happen lots of times. In fact, you probably don't realise how well-trained even doctors' receptionists are to actually filter out some of that. Actually, if you ring and describe that the person is with you has got symptoms that could be a stroke, they'll tell you to ring 999 straight away in the vast majority of cases. So GP practices already have very good systems in place to deal with things like that. And as we roll out a lot more over the next couple of years in this plan, a lot more clinical triage, far more people will be assessed by a clinician about that and sort of the nature of the problem and the urgency of it.
Thank you. So I'm going to take a question about the gentleman with the shirt sleeves rolled up.
Hey.
Yes. I don't quite know how to describe
Mine's about the GP practices, a global question, because I think right at the beginning of the presentation was something about reducing numbers of clinical staff, and that has a context. That's not a given, and I think I want to just say that the reducing numbers of clinical staff is to do with the austerity measures of the government, the cuts in public spending, the underfunding of health. So you can't put that in without contextualising, I think. So important point, really. And lots of nurses are retiring because their conditions are being attacked and so on. So the context is very important, and you could begin to address the context rather than the problem. My main thing is, though, that if some GP practices are currently providing a very good service, and that's true of my GP practice, I ring and I can get an appointment same day usually, and that's fine. You're talking about local groupings of GPs. There's a possibility that you're going to up the workload of the GP practice I currently attend, so I will no longer be able to get a same-day appointment because I'll be filling up their appointment slots with people from other practices. And you're saying local. Now, how big is local? Because at the moment, I can walk to my GP. It's on a bus route. It's easily accessible. How are you going to network GP practices? So I'm thinking what you're doing is you're reducing to the lower common denominator rather than bringing the ones that aren't functioning up to the better standard. So where are these? I'm assuming there must be GP practices, therefore, with a not enough work, because right. You're going to give them some more work.
Three questions there. So I'm going to move us on to answer the three questions. Anthony, can you start with the context bit for...
The workforce stuff,
yes.
Yeah. So,
could you keep your reply brief, then we can get round?
Yeah. So, Sheffield is fairly well catered for with GPs at the moment. Because it is an attractive place to live and work, it has generally kept good GP numbers compared to many other places in the country up until this point. Numbers within Sheffield's GP training scheme were full until a couple of years ago and have started to drop off. So GP retention, is it dying? GP retention, GP retirement, and numbers of GPs in training is an issue. And I think that as a health system, we can't assume that we'll be able to preserve the same GP numbers across the whole city, and including in your practice in the future. The other factor I'd like to touch on about working in neighbourhoods is that if the practice down the road that is maybe struggling more and can't recruit and then falls over, all of those patients will then come to your practice and your practice gains a problem. So actually working collectively together to address the issue is actually a far more sustainable and sensible way to do it than a survival of the fittest type model.
Brian, I want to pick on you. I think you also suggested in the bit about workforce that we as a CCG should be tackling some of the root causes of the problems of funding in the NHS. Would you like to make a comment on that?
Well, I think not to become political in terms of we get the money that we get in into this system. We try and use it in the best way that we can. What we're trying to do with these proposals is make the city as attractive as we can for people to want to work in, so people like Anthony won't leave or retire early and will actually stay because it's an attractive place to work.
When can I retire?
The workload, not yet, the workload is manageable and it's trying to actually do the right thing for Sheffield. So not to be political about are we overfunded, underfunded. We are underfunded, we know that. But what we're trying to do is use the best way, the money that we have, and make it as attractive for people to want to come work, because we've got two universities that actually train a number of our future workforce. We want to keep them in the city, and we'll do that by making the services that they provide attractive to want to stay in the city.
Thank you. I'm going to take another question now. I'm going to go to this side of the room, but I will come back. The lady there.
I want to use slideshow.
Oh, hang on, just wait for the microphone, please. Yes, you do have to use it, please.
Under one of your slideshows, it was under We Are Not, you said this winter, you're not making cuts this winter. That's quite a shady thing to say, because does that mean come after winter that you're going to start making cuts?
Okay. Kate, can you answer that, please?
Yes, that was really just to address any concerns that we might be making changes this winter and concerns about how that may change patients' attendance flows. So no, we're not planning on making any changes this winter. As it stands at the moment, we don't think that we're going to make any significant changes over the next 6 to 12 months, but we are, if we go forward with these proposals, and that is an if, we are in a kind of phased process and we will need to roll it out over the next sort of 1 to 2 years to get to the end point by April 2020.
Kate, can you just go back to the point you said in your presentation? Our proposals aren't a cheaper proposal, because this lady has used the word cut. So could you just go back to that point, please?
Yes, so just to reiterate, this isn't about taking any money out of the current system. So we are expecting to use the money that we currently spend on urgent primary care services and keep that amount of money the same. What we are proposing to do is move that money around services.
Well, I just say, as an NHS worker, that by cuts, it's not necessarily money. It's about reduction of services, because there is shortfalls, as you said, in staffing and in other areas, and it's about moving services around. I mean, you've said in here about your mental health. You know, mental health in Sheffield at the moment are going through a massive, massive reconfiguration and a massive reduction. So it's cuts not about money, it's also about reduction in services.
In a sense, I agree, because it's about services. And if you think about what the NHS spends its money on, apart from gas bills and electricity bills and so on, and, you know, buying drugs, the vast majority of the spend in the NHS is on its staff, 2/3. So actually, when we're talking about what we spend money on, we're talking about resource in NHS, we're actually talking about the people you see, yeah? So when we're talking about keeping that cost envelope the same, we're essentially saying that the same amount of money will be spent on staff. Now, that will essentially mean more staff in the community, in those neighbourhoods in the future. And in terms of the centres that we're talking about, that staffing will be condensed into fewer, more efficient number of places. But that greater number of staff in the community, in those neighbourhoods of general practice, will mean that that's what will enable that greater access. And the vast majority of us do not choose to go and access services at 9, 10, 11, 12 o'clock unless we absolutely have to. Some of us are forced to because we couldn't be seen at a more reasonable time to us. So actually maximising the access in core general practice hours and into the evening in the extended hours arena is how we maximise the best use of our staff and make the services the most responsive as they can be to the public.
Thank you. I'm just thinking of the other point that was within your second statement about mental health. And Kate, you said at the beginning this is about physical and mental health. Could one of you just expand on that, please? Kate?
Yeah, so we recognise that there are service changes being proposed for mental health in kind of general terms. I suppose, from an urgent care point of view rather than from a specific mental health agenda, we are clear that patients have mental health as well as physical health needs that need to be addressed on an urgent same-day basis. And they range from low level mental health issues such as anxiety and depression that can be very significant for the individual patient that's been affected by it, but is perhaps from a clinical perspective not as serious as other diagnoses when patients go into crisis. In terms of the urgent primary care, I think what we're reflecting is that mental health is a significant need in the city at the moment, and the proposals that we are making are designed to support every level of urgent mental health need, whether that's the low-level stuff, as well as the patients that are entering into a crisis situation. And it's about getting the right person to the right health professional in a timely manner.
Thank you. The gentleman in the stock, I've got 1, 2, 3, and then I'm going to go to this side of the room. Okay.
Thank you. My name's Tony. And can I congratulate you as someone who's hard of hearing? I've heard every word. I've not necessarily understood every word, but I've heard every word. Thank you very much. My question is about how local will the local 16 centres be? Because if you're going to sell it in my community, which is Healy, Gleadless Valley, in this extra information you're going to bring out in the next week, if you were to say, this is your local centre, then people would be able to grasp how local is local. So have you already identified the 16 local centres?
Thanks, Tony. So I think in the room we've got copies of a map, which some of you might have seen. Okay. So within that highlights the 16 groupings that we've got and the practices that make up those groupings. And hopefully you'll see it's around populations of between the 30 to 50,000 because we are, you found it, great. So we are a big city, but actually it's quite condensed. So actually it is very local, unlike in a rural area where those practices would be very, very widely spread. And part of our next steps really is to start doing an assessment on a neighbourhood basis as to things like bus routes, travel times between all of those practices within a neighbourhood. Also, you've talked about the centres. Again, a next step for us is to start having conversations, as Kate has said, with those neighbourhoods to start working through what that model is. So it might be there are centres in each neighbourhood. There might be one, there might be two or three, depending on the health needs of the population and the way that neighbourhood, that group of practices working with its patients, wants to organise itself. So where we are at the moment are the lines on the map and the GP groupings where they are working together. Because it is a consultation process, of course, you know, there's not a blueprint here, so that this is around us working together with the practices in terms of what does that look like in more detail in the future. So I couldn't tell you that your practice in your neighbourhood is going to be, that's the centre. We've got some work to do.
Yeah, just to say, realistically, in most neighbourhoods, none of the practice buildings are necessarily huge enough that you could house all of the extra staff and all of the acute on the day minor illness in one place. So realistically, it's about that network of practices working as a collective, making sure that everybody's needs are met. Now, the vast majority of people may well be seen in their own practice, because you say, as the other gentleman said, most practices are meeting their demand. But it's about meeting that extra bit. And if that means that a few patients from that practice that day get seen at the next door practice, that's the bit that makes a difference. That makes sure that everybody gets seen and nobody needs to go and access a centre somewhere else.
Yeah, so just to add, for those of you that are geographically challenged like me, that map is not as helpful as it could be, because I haven't got a clue. Well, I know where I live, but in terms of where I am on the map, I struggle with that. So next week, we are going to put some further information on the website. We're going to try and blow that map up so we will have a picture of each local group in a kind of bigger picture, so it's a bit clearer. We have done the mapping of travel times by bus and by car from every practice to every other practice in the city, and from every practice to the Northern General, the walk-in centre and the minor injuries unit. And we've also looked at the bus routes and the frequency of those buses between those areas. So again, next week, we're going to put some more information on the website so that you, as long as you know which practice you belong to, you can work out which local group of practices you would be within, where they are, and what the current bus and journey times are, and how much, you know, how difficult or easy it would be for you to get within those.
Okay. Now, there was a sea of hands, and the lady at the end, and then that lady.
Oh, it's me
first. Oh, well, well, the lady there, then the lady at the end.
I like when people are assertive.
I have been here before, actually, and on the last one I have to come back, and I've read it now. But first of all, the neighbourhood centres, I do know it has been actually quite successful in the profiles with some people I know. They've actually experienced that. However, I've got two things. One is the students, transient people, and the other is the elderly. And the I came last time and I found out information this time, and I came and said, my daughter is registered in London. She does have what I'd say minor illnesses, sort of urgent care in terms of tonsillitis and things like that. And I did phone up my GPs, and yes, you can register it as a temporary. However, she cannot get any emergency care. She has to go. It was a 3-week waiting list. Because she's only registered temporary, she would not have been able to get that 24 hours straight away. So how can you assure us? And how can you assure us that, because there'll be lots of people like that, students, transient people who come, holiday makers who come, how can you assure us that people who have registered somewhere else will be able to get access same day without having to go miles away?
Okay.
I've got one more question.
Yeah, can we take that?
Yeah.
And I might come back to
elderly.
Okay,
from the point of view of the elderly, it's the fifth largest city, fourth largest city. It's the second largest area we've got in the country. Sheffield is the second largest area. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is the span of where people reside is quite massive all around. And therefore, if you're living on the south side of the city, to get to the northern jail, I know you're saying neighbourhood centres are going to come, but there will be situations where people will have to go to the other side of the city. And elderly will find that very difficult. Also, all this like, well, we'll phone up for the, for the elderly, well, we can look at a bus timetable and you do this. I know my mother, who's 90, would be completely confused. I'd be more confusing. Whereas going to the GP walk-in centre, and I know how to access all that by phoning up out of hours. So I'm just saying that is a big thing. You might think it's easier for us, it would be, for the neighbourhood, but for the elderly, if they've got to work out which bus to do, and it would be quite anxiety provoking.
Can I remind people, we've got loads of people with their hands up, so can we keep the questions succinct? Not a criticism, but that'd be helpful. No, we're getting an answer to the questions first, then I'll come to you.
Thank you. I'll try and keep the answer succinct as well.
Please.
So if we take students as an example, so within, is this on? Yeah. So we've got, again, a neighbourhood that where the predominant population is the student population, and also that there's a degree of a transient population within that sort of city centre approach. So a key priority of that neighbourhood is to start looking at what the offer for students coming into our city is going to be. So we are doing a separate piece of work. So we recognise that a key user of the walk-in centre, for example, would be the student population. Some of that is students who come in from abroad who don't quite understand how to use the system, so they use that as their single access point. So we are working with there's two key university practices in this city. We are working with them to see how we might improve that offer, both in hours and out of hours, and also using technology that students are more used to using, rather than perhaps the elderly are less used to using. So again, it's about meeting those health needs. So as we look to think about, you know, doing something different in that city centre, it's how we support those services. So it is also looking about sort of the impact on if we move services from one part of the city, what does that mean to that remaining population? And that's the conversation we're having with those
Could
practices.
You address the question about how elderly people are going to manage this system that sounds complex.
the lady that's asked the question.
Yes, yeah. Though, of course, the system that we've got at the minute is also very, very complex, isn't it? And it's hard to navigate. Isn't it? Okay. So, all right, okay. So yes, absolutely. But again, that comes back to what their local area is going to offer the elderly population. And it might be that within that area, there is more need to have more care closer to home. It might also be that we have to be clearer about that care navigation. So when the elderly person phones up 111 or their local practice, that, you know, we are clear that actually they need some support with that care navigation and that signposting. And, of course, the practice's responsibility to the elderly person does not go away. This is not about, you know, spreading the responsibility more thinly across the city. And actually, a lot of our elders are the folk who do need that continuity of care. They do need to see their GP on an ongoing basis. They need that relationship. So actually, me phoning up my practice and being signposted to a pharmacist or to a physio, which frees up space for the GP to see my old dad, who's had a stroke, has diabetes and a little bit demented, because actually he needs to see that GP. That's what this is about. When it comes down to how folk actually access the urgent treatment centre, we'll need to be thinking about what all that transport implication for all the patients is going to be.
Thank you. Brian, do you want to add to that?
Just adding to that as well, and it's about whatever model we end up choosing. Part of it is, and it comes back to this point, it's not this winter, so we aren't changing anything. So we will need to work with you and with everyone in Sheffield to actually start promoting and making, helping people understand how and where they access those services. So we need to make sure that whatever model it ends up being, it's clear to the public about where and how they access it. So part of that sort of campaign of you know, what used to be in the Sheffield Star 10 years ago about when you meet two A&E units, which one's open Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, which one's Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It's getting that clear in the public's mind about how and when, where they access the right services.
Right, can I tell you who the next four questions are from? And then I'll pick the next four. The lady at the end, the lady in the striped jumper, the lady in black, and the lady in maroon with specs, and then I'll come back.
Right.
I'm trying to... No, you're not fourth. The lady behind you is fourth.
Oh, so when am I then?
You'll be in the next batch. Right. I am looking at when the hands are going up, so I'm trying to be fair here. The lady at the end.
All right, thank you. Yes, I've got two serious eye conditions, so I'm particularly concerned about the proposals for urgent eye care. I'm very relieved to hear that there's no proposal to close the Hallamshire Emergency Eye Clinic. And I think from what's been said and from what I've read, that I won't be able any longer to just walk into the Hallamshire Emergency Eye Clinic. Is that the case?
Kate, do you want to take that?
No, you will still be able to walk in. So there was a misprint in the original consultation document that we're in the process of rectifying. So you can currently walk into the emergency eye clinic, and you will still be able to walk into the emergency eye clinic.
Okay, that's actually very important, because what I heard, it sounded to me as though access to eye care would be, delayed. It would become a two-stage process. First of all, you get referred to see somebody who's going to, without the expertise and the access to high-tech equipment that they have in the Hallamshire, and then you possibly would be referred to the Hallamshire. But that is not the case.
Yeah.
So there are a small group of patients where that may happen because of the nature of their condition. However, what we're proposing at the moment, the emergency eye clinic is staffed by specialist nurses,
yes,
with consultant level support kind of over and above. What we're looking at is using optometrists with advanced training to provide the service out in the community, potentially with some of the specialist nurses, and that's some of the detail that we're working through at the moment. So the optometrists with the advanced training are at a similar level of skills and experience to the specialist nurses in the hospital. And clearly, in terms of assessment, we would need to replicate the diagnostic facilities that you've got that are currently at the hospital out in the community. This is about recognising and identifying the right group of patients and making sure they get to the right level of service. So at the moment, we have anecdotal feedback of patients with conjunctivitis, for example, going to the emergency eye clinic, or patients with dry eyes because they're really uncomfortable and, you know, and they're really worried about whether it's anything serious or not. Those groups of patients are often going to the emergency eye clinic and they don't need to be. And it's about ensuring that they can be seen far more locally and their conditions managed in an appropriate manner. That does mean that for some patients, in the same way as happens now, when patients go to the GP or contact the GP and ask for an appointment and it becomes apparent that actually they don't need a GP, they need an emergency response, there will be a few patients where that happens in eye care as well. But it's about, we think the process of the triage should mean that the most people get to the right place first time.
Can I just ask you just to repeat what you said? So it will still be possible to walk into the Hallamshire Emergency Eye Clinic?
Yes.
That's for sure.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
I'm going to move us on. The lady in the striped top, sort of in the middle there.
Thanks. I've got quite a lot of the same concerns as other people have raised today, but I won't, because you want us to be quick, I won't go on, but particularly about the eye hospital and the complexity of the new system, which currently I find very easy to manage, and I think other people feel the same. One of the things I wanted to ask was, it seems like you've already decided you're closing these facilities, so it doesn't really feel like a proper consultation. The only options that are on offer are at the Northern General. You know, is that the case? I mean, if enough people in the consultation object to closures of things in the south of the city, you know, will that therefore not happen? And in sort of relation to cuts or closures, we've mentioned that it's ophthalmologists who will be an optician's practices which will be doing the urgent eye care work. Is that going to mean job losses for people who currently work in the emergency eye care? And finally, you know, reorganisation itself costs money, you know, to do the reorganisation. Is that money going to be extra, or is that included? Is that going to be actually taken away from the existing services?
So three points to your question, Brian.
So please. First question was, is it a consultation? Have we all already decided? No. What we did was we spent a lot of work trying to build up a series of options, which is what we're consulting on. And we had to make a preferred option based on the evidence and the analysis that we've done. The reason why we are out to consultation is to test that with you and with the public. We've already had over 500 responses to that consultation. The fact that we want to extend it because there is the interest there and we want to get more feedback is there is a genuine regard to what people are saying. So have we decided what we're going to do? No. We had a preferred option that we're talking to you about. There are other options there as well, and we need to respond to that feedback. And that feedback that we get will be independently analysed, so it won't be us in the CCG taking it away in a darkened room, burning it, and then making our own decision. We won't do that. That will be independently analysed, given to us, and then we will need to make a decision based on that feedback. The only cost to the reorganisation is the engagement exercise that we're doing in terms of printing leaflets. The website doesn't cost a significant...
The impact of changing services swallows up money. Could you address that, please?
We'll need to manage that change through our normal process. We're not trying to spend money needlessly, just changing for the sake of it. What we're trying to do is arrive at a model that works for the city.
on that point, though, Mandy, it's worth saying that the CCG hasn't spent money on external people for this. It's all internal staff that are already on the payroll, if you like. That's worth a point worth making.
Thank you. And then the third bit of the point the lady raised was about will staff at the eye clinic lose their jobs? Any staff at the eye clinic lose their jobs?
We don't anticipate any staff job losses in the emergency eye clinic. Currently, actually, there's a shortage of ophthalmologists and eye care staff around South Yorkshire, and we think this will help support that.
Thank you. Right, I'm moving on. The lady in the black. when I finish with this batch of four, I will take some more questions.
Thanks. I wanted to ask about how responsive to need the GP and these other clinicians who will work in the neighbourhoods will be. So is there a plan to review use and need and demand on a regular basis? And how will supply and demand be managed? And before you start the whole plan off, how confident are you that the correct coverage will be in place at the start? Because it seems to me that if it's not right, perfect from the start, then the whole plan falls down and people will still be flooding to the urgent treatment centre.
100% right.
Other tiny thing as well. Because I don't like money being wasted on buying private services in that could be done through the NHS. The other clinicians that you've mentioned, who I'm now gathering will be people like optometrists and so on, and physiotherapists and so on. Will they be NHS employees or will they be bought in? Okay. Thanks.
So that's two different questions, Anthony.
Yeah. So if you think about one of these neighbourhoods here on the map, as we think about how they're going to develop over the next couple of years, and as Kate said, we're giving ourselves two and a bit years to develop this. It's not an overnight change. Absolutely, demand management or understanding demand is the key first thing. So that's our next thing, actually, in the new year, is to do a serious amount of demand work in some, probably, of the neighbourhoods to really understand on a Monday morning or a Thursday afternoon how many people ring the surgeries in that neighbourhood and what with. How many of them are prescription queries? How many of them are checking on results? And then once you get beyond that, how many of those acute presentations for urgent care are, you know, minor illness, sore throats? Of those, how many of those are suitable to see an advanced nurse practitioner or an urgent care practitioner or somebody else? How many of those, due to their other medical complexities, really need to see a GP in their own practice? And then how many of those are presentations of musculoskeletal problems, a bad shoulder, a bad ankle? How many of those are mental health problems? And of those mental health presentations, how many of those are brand new? How many of those are people with pre-existing mental health problems? Once you understand what people are calling with at different times of the week, yes, absolutely, as you allude to, then you need to know what type of workforce you need in place. Now, actually, it may not be that if we worked out that a neighbourhood required to see have all of its acute musculoskeletal, you know, shoulders and knees, and it needed 1.5 physios a week. Actually, it may be that it's going to get one physio a week. Yeah, so that way, you know, not everybody sees the physio when they ring with a bad shoulder. It might be you have to make do with a rubbish GP. Yeah, but actually, it's once you start understanding the demand and the need, you can then work out what you need, and then you can work out, as we free up resource from changes elsewhere in the system, what funding streams need to go in place. And it will mean, as we said, more other types of clinician, and that'll be physios, mental health workers, and other people who can see the minor illness. But yes, demand, understanding demand at the outset and then revisiting it is going to be a big part of this, absolutely.
That's right.
To be honest, I haven't decided. The thing is, once you've got these more responsive systems in place, it's actually easier than it is now. Yeah, because once you've got these systems in place, you'll be able to tell by how well utilised those new members of staff are. If they're underutilised, you know you've got too much there, and so on and so on. Whereas at the moment, where it's just they're just appointments with GPs, we're going to have to do a piece of groundwork to actually understand the demand. Once this system matures and we have got these new clinicians in place in every neighbourhood working across different sites, it's going to be much easier then, because the systems will be in place, for us to revisit it on a much more regular basis and understand and tweak and so on.
Thanks. Brian, the bit about private. So optometrists are no different than GPs or pharmacists. So they are technically private businesses. So if they provide services to the NHS, they will be reimbursed for that, like GPs are at the minute. So they are part of the NHS, and they're reimbursed through the NHS for the services they provide on the NHS.
So the lady in glasses, and then it's you.
And it's me.
Yes, really. Before you.
Glasses first. Hiya. I don't think this is working.
No,
it's on. Okay. So I've got two questions. The first is sort of philosophical, really. I'm not sure you'll be able to answer it. And the second is more practical, financial. So the first one, I like small is beautiful and simple is beautiful. So I think smallish GP practices work really well because people know their patients and they know their staff, and actually less time is spent kind of communicating, and it's not good enough just to have access to the notes, it's actually knowing who wrote those notes and being able to see them over coffee from time to time makes a huge difference. And I would really like to know the evidence that working in bigger groups actually overall is more efficient and useful. And similarly for the kind of simplicity side that you've talked about, urgent care centres having access to x-rays, blood tests, ECGs. On the face of it, that seems great. You know, the patient gets everything done there and then, sorted, finish. Actually, the way it works is if you have access to more complicated investigations, you use them, and then you find more things, and then it gets more and more and more complicated. And in the end, if you kind of up the game and stop keeping things simple, if you get easy access to more complicated things, you provide more and it actually costs more, and people go through all sorts of investigations they didn't need. So that's the kind of philosophical bit. The second question is shorter, it's more practical. You're talking about a kind of envelope of finance for urgent care, which includes the current hospital-based services in the walk-in centre and GPs out there, the private practices. They are, they're not private practices, are they? But they're independent practitioners. How are you going to work the finances so that you reduce what's offered in hospital, which actually you're not proposing to do, and increase what's offered out in the community? How are you going to get GPs to pick up this offer and provide more work, and how are you going to fund it?
Okay, so answering the first bit, yeah. Kate, the
second bit, yeah? So I think that is much more than a philosophical point. I think that's a very good point. There's actually evidence for both of those things. So a lot of evidence from abroad, particularly thinking New Zealand here, for working in that sort of population level, that 30 to 50,000 scale. And there's a reason why that came out in all the national plans and in the GP strategies nationally. It's because that's above that scale, you lose the ability to have that personal relationship. And obviously, what we're not talking about within these neighbourhoods is them building one building. We're not talking about mergers. We're not talking about super practices. Nobody has got the money to fund building 16 gigantic new practices. That is not going to happen. What we're talking is about that collaborative working that allows for people that don't need that continuity of care, a young person with a sore throat that hasn't seen the doctor in 5 years, that just needs their sore throat dealing with, that's just one example. There's an amount of that that if that is seen by other members of staff, that frees up GP time to actually allow the continuity of care. And that continuity of care obviously picks up on your point, is that actually, yes, if your continuity of care is with a practice that you know, and it's a small practice, there's a small number of GPs, that's where the one that's closest to you, that's where you know, we're very mindful in this change to not lose that. And we can't. We don't want to destabilise that practice. Those patients have to have the ability to go to their practice when it's appropriate. Otherwise, we'd be destroying that practice, and that's absolutely, definitely what we don't want. So it is. It's about making that practice life easier that they've got within their system, in their neighbourhood, that they have got the ability to get the things that don't need to see that GP in that small practice team, that they can go elsewhere.
The second point was about the diagnostics.
And there is again evidence that, you know, if you stick GPs in A&E departments, that they end up working like A&E doctors. They stop behaving like GPs do. I think that the first thing is that the aim is obviously the vast majority of people are seen in their local neighbourhood, so that we're vastly reducing the number of people who are forced, and I use the word advisedly, forced to use another service that's further away from home. And I think that the other thing about the UTCs, the urgent treatment centres, is that we do want them to be GP-led. Then they are going to be distinct and separate from the emergency departments. And therefore, if that team working there is led by GPs, I think that they are more likely to use those diagnostic tests in the way that a GP does. If they need further or more intensive diagnostic tests urgently, they probably need to be in the emergency department, not in the urgent treatment centre.
Kate, the bit about the finance.
Yeah. So in terms of how we're going to move the money around the system, effectively, by the proposals that we've suggested, so by closing the walk-in centre and the minor injuries unit and diverting the patients, the urgent eye care patients that currently go to the emergency service, and replacing those with the urgent treatment centres in the way that we've proposed, we think that will release some money from the services that we currently spend it on, and we'll be able to invest those and the staff that work in those services back into the groups of local GP practices.
Right, the next five are the lady at the end, the lady in the grey jumper, the two ladies at the front, and the chap at the end of row three. And then I'll do the next batch after that.
This lady hasn't had her question.
Yeah, she's number one. She's number one now.
Can I start by just making a comment rather than the questions that I want to ask? The reason you haven't had a lot of people in the consultations is because they didn't know about them. There hasn't been one single consultation available to the people in South Sheffield and South West Sheffield at all accessible. The only one was at the Circle, which was in an evening, and I can't come to evening ones because the bus service is hopeless. Which leads me on to a question. I am in the elderly and vulnerable group. I'm nearer 80 than 70, and I'd like to know how I can get with a minor injury to Northern General Hospital when it takes an average of 2 hours. I've got two buses. Most people in South Sheffield have probably got three buses to catch, some of which only run once an hour at best if it comes. And if it doesn't, you've had it. And they don't run in some parts of South Sheffield after 6 o'clock at all or at weekends. I can't answer the questions about preferred options because none of them are available to me. I simply cannot make it. I couldn't make an appointment at Northern General. The eye clinic as well, I didn't used to be confused at all. I find the system as it is perfectly simple and perfectly easy to understand. I'm not a computer user, and I feel like a third-class citizen in any case. It took me weeks to be able to get a paper copy of this. But the eye care, I also have an eye condition which flares up every now and again. And I can go to the walk-in eye clinic, and I can be seen and out within the maximum it's taken is 35 minutes, which is brilliant. They are the most excellent, it's a gem of the NHS, and to close that would be an absolute sin. Right. I'd like to know the difference between emergency and urgent, because mine, I don't know when I go to the eye clinic whether it is an emergency or urgent, because it's a flare-up. The last time I went, the nurse found within about 5 minutes that it was a foreign body and not a flare-up of the condition. Now, if I'd been asked to go to Northern General, I could end up blind by the time you finish messing about. And believe you me, I'd sue you through every solicitor there was if I did.
Thank you.
Technically, you can only sue me out of the four of us.
So there's three bits to the question. I think we've addressed the bit about the consultation. We've extended it. And we will be having more.
You will
meetings.
Be going to South Sheffield.
Can I just on that, Mandy? Yeah, right. There is more information out there. We have extended the consultation. The first public consultation that we did do was in Broomhill. So we were trying to target that side of the city, but we recognise there is more that we need to do. We are trying to do it through multiple mediums. We aren't just using websites. So we've been in the Sheffield Star.
No, but they didn't give a phone number or anything. Right. It took me ages to get to know about this.
We're addressing the public meetings and we've extended the period. Can I suggest we move on to the issues around healthcare? So the issue is this... not understanding the difference between urgent and emergency eye care and how people are going to manage that.
So we think that part of the answer to that goes back to those original conversations. So when you have an eye problem, it's about either contacting 111 or the GP practice. So we're not talking about 111 as it currently works. Talking about 111 in the future, which is a slightly, well, it will be quite a different model to the way it works now. So in the future, there's A, going to be online access, which currently there isn't, which I appreciate won't help you, but for groups of patients across the city, actually, you know, for some of the students in particular, and having an online platform will be of significant benefit. It also means that when you do ring 111 in the future, you are far more likely to be spoken to by a clinician, and the length of time that you may have to wait to speak to a clinician will be significantly reduced. So you should be able to speak to them at the point at which you originally phone, which for lots of patients doesn't happen now. In terms of the, so knowing where to go, I think what we've recognised is that there's the 111 route, there's the GP practice, and actually for some patients already with eye problems, they choose to go to local opticians because they're, you know, they're closer to home and they go there to ask where
but
to be seen.
But can they prescribe and will they be able to remove a foreign body?
That's absolutely what we're looking at trying to deliver, because what we don't want is for lots of patients to go from one service to then have to go to another service to get treatment. Because that just puts an extra step in the pathway.
So you can assure me that if I go to an optician, they will be able to see me and prescribe antibiotics or whatever drugs are necessary. And if it was a foreign body, they would be able to remove it.
We are in discussion with the ophthalmologist and the optometrist at the moment, but that is absolutely the aim of the proposals, yes. So the other thing that you just touched on was in terms of travel across the city. Yeah. And if you're elderly and if you've got a minor injury or you can't, you know, don't have access to a car, how are we going to manage that? So that is something that we have already taken into consideration, because in reality, with all of these proposals, not everybody is going to be happy in the city. And it's about what we're trying to do is ensure that we improve the services for the majority of the population in the best way that we can. What we have done and what we will need to repeat at the end of the consultation is try and look at different groups of the population and how they may be impacted on by these proposals. So whether that's because of your age, because of health conditions that you've got, because of your whether you speak English as a second language or not, and a whole range of other factors. And we've considered all of those as part of the proposal, as part of getting to this point. But clearly, we will need to revisit all of that at the end of the consultation period, because you will have all given us a lot of information about the issues and challenges that you face. and we'll need to review that when we get to the final decision. Part of that will also be about how do we address some of those issues. So with whichever option that we go down, we know that parking at the Northern General or parking potentially in any other option that we went with would be an issue. And because of the geographical nature of the city, travel from one end of the city to the other end is a problem. And that's something that we will need to be working with organisations like the South Yorkshire Transport Executive and the council to have some of those conversations about actually what can we do in the future to improve that for patients.
Thank you. The lady at the end with the beaded necklace, please.
I'm not going to apologise for picking up on some of the points that have been said before, but what I wanted to do was just to sort of nail them a bit, really, because what I'm hearing is people asking questions and getting half an answer, basically. So my first question is about timing, because you've talked about 2 years and putting these new GP collaboratives, or whatever the right word is, into place. What I want to know is, are those things going to be in place and have been tried and tested before you close anything? That's my first question. My second question is around the issue of the options, which has been touched on a couple of times. And the colleague who I can't see, yeah, the gentleman here, sorry, I've forgotten your name, said that it was a genuine consultation. But the options that you have presented and asked us about do not include an option to keep any urgent treatment provision on this side of the city. Yeah. And for those of us who live on this side of the city, and I've certainly been involved in campaigning and petitioning in Healy and Gleadless Valley, and I have never been involved in a campaign where so many people have been incensed and concerned and worried about the lack of provision. And that cuts across all generations, genders, backgrounds. So as far as I'm concerned, I want to know whether there is genuinely an option to keep some urgent treatment on this side of, on that serves the south of the city. And my third question, you said you've extended the consultation, which is very welcome. Are you going to organise a meeting in January, or would you like some of us to help you organise a meeting in January in the south, in like the Healy, Low Edges, Gleadless Valley area of the city, wood seats where there's been nothing?
Okay, thank you. Brian.
So answering each of those and trying to answer it directly so you don't get half an answer. So would we change anything before we knew an alternative was in place? No. The purpose of the consultation is to try and test, have we got the right model? We would make sure that if it was the right model, we would make sure that any services that were changed were in place before we shut anything else up. That's why the one thing I will emphasise throughout today is we are changing nothing, at least through this winter. So that's the message that people need to take home, that the services that you've got today are the services that will be here for at least this winter. So we aren't changing anything and we don't want to change anything. We need people to turn up and do and receive the treatment in the places that are currently there. Second question, just remind me.
So there's a bit about timing. Are our plans tried and tested anyway? Is there an option for the south of the city?
And the third consultation. So third one, yes, absolutely. And if you want to help us organise a meeting in the south of the city, we will gladly take any offer of where we can have it. But we are actively trying to get that set up. That's why we've extended the consultation. We also need to engage with the north of the city as well, because there is a gap in terms of the responses coming from that. So that's another population that we need to tackle. And I forgot the second question again. There isn't in the three options that we've done, but we need to respond to that feedback. If people are saying that we've missed something, it was in the early, we discounted some of those options, but we need to listen to public feedback for that. Right. Is that, can I just check, is that answering the three questions?
Yes.
Because I don't want people to go with feeling they've only had half answers.
You're not closed to the option of keeping something.
Yeah. Right. My order's been slightly upset by the gentleman.
I'm just holding it for somebody.
You were on my list, so you can go next, given you've got the microphone. Then I'll do the two ladies at the front, then there's a lady at the back, and then the lady in green.
Really, two observations. You mentioned a figure of, say, 500 responses. What about, I don't know how the size of the clinical commissioning group support team, why don't you debunk out of your office and get them into the major treatment centres and hospitals for a week with all this information and questionnaires? You would hit far more than 500. Just get people, sorry to say this, off the bums and talk to people. Just a thought. The second point is, and this is really an observation, I retired because of stress from a large civil service department. I think you would get a lot more consideration and response from the general public if you are honest in saying this is an exercise of more for less. You're not going to get any more money from the government, so you are having to move the deck chairs around with the existing funding that you have. I think if you were clear and open and honest with the general public that that is your game plan, that effectively you would bring an awful lot more people on board. We're not anti what the health service is trying to do, but I think some honesty would bring a lot more people on board.
I want you to answer the bums off seats bit. Anthony, I want you to answer the bit about is this a more for less, or is it something different than that? Yeah. Okay.
So we have been out to the children's hospital, the walk-in centre. We've been out to the universities, the bus station. We've been to some supermarkets. We've been to the Moore Market. So far, we've handed out 10,000 postcards across the city in those venues. We know that's not enough because we're not getting the responses back. We've had 500 responses to the questionnaire. Overall, we think of all the meetings that we've had and the conversations that we've had, and including those kind of conversations when we've been at those different venues, we think we've heard from about 3,000 different people within the city so far. There's other figures that I can quote. We've had 64,000 people so far have looked at our Twitter feed and other Twitter feeds that are other people's Twitter feeds that are talking about these proposals. 8,000 people reached so far on Facebook. So we know that there are people out there and we are accessing those people, but we recognise there's more that we need to do.
Kate, can you talk a bit about the work we did before the consultation, particularly through Health Watch and the Walking Centre and some of that stuff as well, please?
Yes, yeah, so back in sort of June, July time this year, we did some work with what we classed as vulnerable groups across the city. So in the original work, that when we went out to talk to people about urgent care, we realised that we were hearing lots from people in the southwest of the city, lots from whole varieties of communities, but actually very little from particular groups, whether that was groups where English is a second language, students, homeless and those of no fixed abode, drug and alcohol users. So we did a specific piece of work back in June, going and talking not only to the people in those communities, but also to the voluntary sector groups that worked with those communities. And we talked to the staff, and we used some of the staff and some of the members of those communities to have peer conversations with other members of their communities to try and make sure that we're capturing the voices of everybody, because we need to make sure that this consultation reflects the views of everybody in the city, not just those that are able to articulate for themselves. And that's part of why we want to extend the consultation. We've already heard, from the responses that we've had so far to the consultation, when we break it down by postcode, the areas of the southwest of the city are the ones that are feeding back the most. So we're hearing you loud and clear if you live in that area of the city. But what we're not hearing from is anybody in the north of the city or other specific communities. And we need to make sure that we hear from everybody and that everybody has an equal chance to share their voices and their thoughts.
Thank you. I'm going to move the answer on because we've got about half an hour. We've still got a few people who've been more questions to ask. Anthony, is this about more for less or is it something different?
Something different, because obviously, even in the context, the wider political context about there being less money in the system and the NHS having to make, big changes and big efficiencies to balance the books, which is, you only have to read the newspapers or watch the news on the telly to understand that. This particular bit is about, yes, what we're proposing is that there would be fewer big centres that you can access, and there's an efficiency there, but actually we're also proposing that, any money saved by that change is reinvested. And that effectively means that staff move from working in big centres to being based more in your neighbourhood. Now, that's all sorts of different types of staff, as we've already touched on, but it's not it's actually a more bang for your buck type of model rather than a squeezing the system type model. It's actually we use every pound spent on staff more efficiently that way. I think if you think about the whole system, and we touched on that it was 600,000 urgent care appointments in general practice. General practice is where most acute, minor and urgent problems are seen. And actually, we don't need to expand general practice. We don't need to double it. We just need to increase it by a certain amount to mop up the unmet need at the moment that overflows into these other centres that we're talking about. So it is a more efficient model, actually.
Hello. I've just got a couple of different questions. One about the walk-in centre and the consultation on that. It's sort of mentioned in the briefing pack that the sort of majority of users of that are students and young professionals. So sort of what outreach efforts will you be making specifically for that group of their views on the sort of changes to the city centre option? Because I'm conscious that a lot of those people may not be registered with GPs, may not have access to public transport. And so a city centre option is quite useful for those people because it's very accessible on public transport and on foot. The other thing I'd like to pick up on is a couple of answers in your questions, which were about sort of study. There was the one about sort of studying what people call GPs with and call and request urgent appointments with. And so the question was, I mean, isn't that something that should happen first before you propose the changes rather than after, as part of the process of implementing the changes? And sort of similarly to that, something that was mentioned in Kate's presentation was around how some practices are already doing a very good job in terms of the availability of GP same-day appointments, whereas some are struggling. Are there sort of any options that were explored as part of your options analysis in terms of supporting the practices that are not succeeding in that to do whatever the ones that are doing it well are doing in order to sort of address that problem within the current system? And then the last one is related to that. It's about phasing, which is I think something that might alleviate some of the concerns that people have raised here would be if the materials you could put online really set out the order in which you plan to do things, so that people really understand, you know, what will be in place before anything is closed and so on.
Katrina, are you going to answer? I suggest we sort of do it slightly backwards, the one about support practices.
Yes, so I think it's also going back to the point that we've made in the briefing pack around this isn't going to happen overnight. So there's a direction of travel with this. And if you look on our website, we've got our primary care strategy. We've got what's called the GP Forward View Plan, which is about actually supporting practices, individual practices and practices within those groupings to be, and it's a bit jargonistic, I apologise, but to remain resilient and to be sustainable as individual practices, but also to support them in working within that grouping. And a key benefit of working in the grouping is to actually enable GPs from one practice to share what they do with another practice, particularly within that community, because actually the community and the health needs are very, very similar. And so my role within the CCG and with my team as primary care is actually supporting all 82 practices in the city to strengthen, to become more modern. So some of the stuff we're putting in, we've talked about what we call care navigation. So that's that signposting of the receptionist to different services is already being put in train in many practices, and we're working with the rest of the practices across the city to enable that to happen. So in the meantime, there's a massive amount of work that's going on almost regardless of this to support practices to enable them to continue to provide the great services that hopefully you think you do get from your practice. but it is not sustainable on an individual practice basis. We have worked with the GPs. They are telling us it's great that you're getting a great service, but actually there is a cost to them in terms of their getting up earlier in the morning and getting home later at night. And with stuff like that, that means they're going to be looking to retire earlier. If we can make their working life more palatable, they will stay. They will stay and provide you with a great service. So that's what we're basically trying to put forward. So please be assured, work is happening today as we speak.
Kate, you're doing the other two bits of the question. And yeah. Anthony, you might come in as well, might you?
So in terms
I was going to mention something about the students, but
no, go. So in terms of the students, in terms of how we're actually accessing the students as part of the consultation, so we've been trying to work directly with the students' unions of both universities. That's not gone quite as we've planned so far because of the elections. It's not been very helpful. So we are trying alternative routes in. So we've got a meeting this week with the student university practice to talk to them about their specific concerns. And we're using students who are happy to advocate and get the message out there as a kind of a peer-to-peer way to get those messages out. And I think, I can't remember off the top of my head, but she's already got 100 questionnaires out and completed. So we're trying to use different ways of accessing the student population. In terms of
students and young people.
Yes. Well, there's also a whole range of other local groups within the city, like Chili Pep and the Carers Forum, Young Carers. There's a whole range of services that we are going through those routes in order to engage in the students and the young people's voices. In terms of the services that we will provide for the students, Katrina and Anthony have already touched on those because we are clear that those groups of the population have specific needs and they may be quite different to needs of the other groups, and that goes back to how those neighbourhoods and those practices within those local groups of GP practice work. In terms of the study with the GP data, yes, absolutely. We've done it once already. That did inform the modelling. We've just done it again last week to retest that information and do it across a much wider footprint. We struggle because as a country, it is not the kind of information that is routinely collected. So we have had to do something locally. We've done it once, we've just done it again, and we'll be reviewing that information in the next week or so.
You just speaking to the two university practices, they are very confident. If you look at the numbers of students that go, they need to a piece of work in conjunction with the universities and student unions to maximise the registrations that we've already touched on. But they're very confident they can meet that demand. As they start working together as a neighbourhood and start actually making sure they meet that demand, again, you know, the number of students that would need to go to the walk-in centre falls. The other thing is, to pick up on Katrina's point, is that acute, minor, urgent appointments is not the only thing that practices do. And as a percentage of all appointments, not just GP appointments, all appointments, including healthcare assistants and nurses and so on, it's actually not the biggest part. And working together in neighbourhoods, as we've discussed, the things that they can do together benefits all of those parts of what general practice does, and so the whole system becomes more efficient. And a member of general practice staff is not a one-trick pony. They can help with the urgent care, but they can also help with long-term conditions management and so on and so on. So again, it's another example of where a pound spent in general practice, if you like, is a more efficient use of the pound.
Now, I know who the next three are. So there's the lady at the back, the lady at the front in the striped top, and then the lady in turquoise top. We've got 25 minutes. Is there anybody else? So, right. You've already asked a question, haven't you? So if you don't mind, I'm not going to come back to you. So then we've got those three people there. Okay. So the lady at the back, please.
Hello. Mine's going to be very quick. Will the urgent treatment centres be open 24/7?
So in terms of being able to walk in to the urgent treatment centre, at the moment we're proposing that they would be open 8 a.m. in the morning till 11 p.m. at night, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year. For the service overnight, so from 11 p.m. until 8 a.m, that would be through a booked only appointment. So, as in, you'd have to ring up and get an appointment booked and confirmed, because that's the way it works now. It works quite well.
But during the day, you'll have an offer of either walking in and waiting or a booked appointment.
Okay, thank you. The lady in the striped top at the front.
So my question is, you were talking about putting the urgent treatment centre at the Northern in case the problems were more serious and the people needed to go into A&E. You also said that this proposal is to include mental health. So I'm wondering why the CMHT is an out-of-hours urgent mental health teams aren't included in the proposals, because if you have even just an urgent problem, looking at these segments, sending people to places within this segment that they're not familiar with is going to be impractical, never mind to the Northern. Also, A&E is a terrible place to send people in crisis anyway.
The acronym that was used, which is Community Mental Health Teams. Perhaps if you could give a bit of background.
So I'll try and give a bit of background because it's not my area of expertise. But effectively, so the Community Mental Health Teams deal with patients with mental health conditions from an ongoing perspective. So it's where you need more support than your general practice can currently provide you, and Anthony will probably be able to provide a bit more information on that. So in terms of, I think what your question was, how does citing something at the Northern General benefit and link into those services? So I think there's something about absolutely recognising that patients in mental health crisis, A&E is not the most appropriate place for them to be. And for us, that's an advantage of citing the urgent treatment centre at the Northern General, because it's an opportunity to bring them out of A&E and site them in a service that's next door to it, potentially next door on the same site, but it's in a bit of a more calm, more considered environment. So for us, that's an advantage. In terms of how we link into the community mental health teams, that's something that we're looking at, working between the mental health commissioners and the primary care commissioners, and how we link the neighbourhoods together. Because in some areas of the city, the structures that we've got do not fit in neatly into the 16 neighbourhoods. So it's then how do we group neighbourhoods together, or the groups of local GP practices together, into a bigger footprint to then work with those community mental health teams. Does that make sense? Anthony, is there anything you want to add?
The gentleman with the zipped top on, can somebody pass him the mic, please?
Yes. Sorry.
And then it's the two ladies.
Thank you.
Sorry, gentlemen, I have got you on the list. So, the gentleman and then you. Apologies. I've got a list here, and I missed you.
Sorry.
She's in charge.
I'm sorry for. I apologise to start with for going back to this, but we're back to travelling. I live at Meadowhead, and I rely on public transport. I know, I think it was Kate mentioned that you've checked the buses and bus times and so on. But last time I had an appointment at the Northern General, there were two consecutive buses missing. Of course, it had to be that morning. So I finished up in a taxi, which cost me £14. So my main concern, I have an ongoing eye problem, and my main concern is losing the eye clinic at the Hallamshire. I'm not an urgent case. It's not an emergency. It's just an annual checkup, really. But I'm very concerned about losing that. As a matter of interest, by the way, it takes about half the time to get to Chesterfield Royal as it does to get to the Northern General from where I live. And can I just say as well that I'm fortunate in being with what I consider probably one of the best practices in the country, in the city, at Woodseats. And Tony, Anthony didn't pay me to say that. Anthony didn't pay me to say that.
The only thing I would just add is that if you have annual checkups at the eye clinics at the Hallamshire, there will be no change to those.
Okay. Right. One thing I want to know is what will happen to other services currently provided at the walk-in centre site, such as physiotherapy. I'm pleased that you are taking into account that you need to look at transport, because as for many others here,
getting to the Northern General is absolute hell for me. I'm concerned that I still don't know how to tap into local urgent care for visitors coming into the city, students home for the Christmas holidays, family members visiting from other areas of the country. Are they all going to have to go to the Northern General? Nobody in my family drives. Nobody. So it's hell for all of us getting there. And I'm also interested to know where people are on the edge of one GP grouping, but could conveniently access surgeries in the neighbouring group. Would they have the option of being seen in the surgery in the neighbouring group? Because we're right on the border between two.
Well, yes. I mean, I think most student courses involve you spending the majority of the year where you are a student. So generally, you are encouraged to register where you are studying. And in some ways, that's a very important safety net while you're away from home, when you're still a young person. I think it's very important that you can have a doctor's surgery that you are registered with. If you have health problems while you are there studying, that's when you're going to be experiencing stress and mental health problems. It's really important that you have a local GP surgery. So, and that's a very important part of getting the students registered, that they get that local practice that is both responsive and able to meet their ongoing needs while they're here studying in the city. On the subject that's been raised a couple of times now about people who come and visit and have to access healthcare services, that's normally because of an acute urgent problem. Occasionally it's for things like running out of pills and so on, but actually, for, you know, if actually you contact your local surgery and say, oh, I've got my mum with me for Christmas and she's unwell, that GP, they're in their area. So they have a contractual obligation to see them as an immediately necessary treatment. So they shouldn't be treated any differently from a registered patient in actual fact. Now, if actually that GP surgery is struggling to meet demand, that's one of the things that we will be changing and improving with the neighbourhood working in the future, is that the access will be better. So a visitor will benefit just as much as a registered patient.
Thank you. There's two of the bits to the transport thing, I think we've heard, we've absolutely locked the transport bit, but there was physio at the walk-in centre and going across the edges of neighbourhoods. Mm. Katrina,
I pick up the physio bit first, yeah. As the person who commissions the service, and slightly confused from the CCG that I wasn't aware that we commission physio services from the walk-in centre. So that is something I'd like to look into as to why they're providing it and how they're providing it. But also our proposal is about providing that physiotherapy out in the community, and that's what we prefer to be seen if people need to access that. So we'll have to do a bit of looking into what physiotherapy services are available within the walk-in centre. So thank you for making me aware of that.
Thank you. The bits about neighbourhoods.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And I think that the key underlying principle of neighbourhoods is not to build false borders around this city. So if you are in a practice that borders a neighbourhood, it'll be an interesting challenge for those neighbourhoods. But absolutely, yes. We have got managers who work on what we call a locality basis, and actually they've got a bigger responsibility in terms of footprint. But actually what we also need to do is if something well is working in one neighbourhood, then actually it's our responsibility as the citywide organisation is to share that across the city, and where if it fits in a neighbouring neighbourhood, then that needs to happen quickly as well. But this is not about putting false borders up around this city.
We've got just under 10 minutes. There's certainly two people, and if we've got time, we might have a third. So the lady at the back.
Yeah. You've addressed the difficulty of transport for elderly, mobile people. What about people with a disability? Because my husband is disabled, he's in a wheelchair. I'm his full-time carer. He has we go to has a long-term neurological condition. When we go to the memory clinic, we have hospital transport. When he's had to go to the Hallamshire, I've had to pre-order wheelchair taxi. Now, if I'm not concerned with the GP, because the GP will come out. Our GPs have been marvellous. But if I have to take him anywhere else in an emergency, what do I do? Dial 999. I really don't know what to do. And if I need to go anywhere, how do I access things as well as a carer? Because, I mean, I've had to employ a carer this afternoon to sit with my husband. So I could be here. So
thank you for doing that. I think that if we sort of pan that scenario out, the system will have failed somewhat if your husband had to travel to a UTC at the Northern General for minor illness, for example. Yeah, that is not the intent. The intent would be is if he's unwell one morning that you can ring the doctor's surgery, and if you have the capability of getting him down there to an appointment with an appropriate professional, you can do so. If he's essentially housebound and he needs a home visit, that continues, that doesn't change. Absolutely, I think that the only reason you should realistically have to go to the Northern General with him is if something happens that's much more serious and potentially life-threatening. So if he's got new neurological symptoms, you're worried he's having a stroke or chest pain or unusual shortness of breath, those are things that are entirely appropriate uses of 999. And again, that's an emergency service response, and that is not what we're consulting on here. That is that doesn't change. But someone who is a higher need patient, someone who's frail, elderly, potentially housebound, you'd want that response that dealt with that patient's need on the day to be done locally. You wouldn't want them to have to fall back on the urgent treatment centre, because that's not the correct system. That's not what you would want to happen, is it?
I do know several other people throughout the city in similar circumstances. And one of the main concerns are falls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And whether transferring from wheelchair to bed or with whatever aids we have, there is always that risk of falls. Yeah. And sometimes I have used the minor injuries at the Hallamshire, and sometimes I have used Northern General, and in one case I have dialed 999.
Yeah.
I have used my common sense. Now I am a little bit more aware, worried, and I think a lot of carers in similar situations will also be worried.
And it's a difficult situation, isn't it? Because people make a judgment call when that happens. How is this person injured? Yeah, can I safely get them off the ground? Do I need help? And actually, again, if you know the relative in question, in this case, obviously theoretically talking about your husband, is, you know, in crying out in pain, and they appear to be hurt, then actually it's probably you'd ride ring 999, wouldn't you? And you'd be right to. So because you know the cavalry come calling and can assess for injuries and transport to the place where they can assess for the injuries. So whereas if you know, someone can be picked up off the ground, put back into bed, put back into a chair. You know, if it's the daytime, you ring your practice, they can get the appropriate people out. Neighbourhoods in the future may want to try and make sure that there is someone around that neighbourhood that can respond even late in the afternoon to house calls, yeah, which at the moment a single practice struggles to do. If it's in the middle of the night, again, unfortunately, carers have to make a judgment call. You pop the person back in the bed, can this wait till morning? But actually, if you ring 111, you get put through to effectively a clinician, we will still have GPs who can visit in the middle of the night in the same way that we've always had. We're not getting rid of that element of the service.
Right, thanks, Anthony. We've got time for one question. I'll catch you after the meeting. So the lady sat next to you, please.
Yeah.
I just want to raise the dreaded bank holiday scenario because I've been very grateful for the walk-in centre. I live in Crooks. I was able to get to the walk-in centre. It took me 25 minutes. I don't drive. If you have support services as well as GPs, and I'm very sad to hear that it's not very palatable for GPs to work in the NHS anymore, but there are lots of other support staff that work in the NHS. How are they going to cope with things like outbreaks, you know, when it's the flu season? You're going to have a very fluid pool of staff, as far as I can see. You're going to be expecting them to meet needs in certain communities where there may be worse health problems because they may be more vulnerable. How are you going to get the staff to these areas? And also, you're not going to lose the support staff because their lives have now become more unpalatable.
Anthony, are you answering that?
So the second point first about the staff resilience, if you can imagine that a neighbourhood now is as however many GPs, as a smaller number of practice nurses, a smaller number again of healthcare assistants, we're trying to change the nature of that workforce, aren't we? So that there will be advanced nurse practitioners seeing minor illness, there might be urgent care practitioners who are a bit like paramedics seeing minor illness, that there are physios in that general practice team, that there are mental health workers working in that general practice team. Although the mix of people in the team is different, all of those members of staff will be hopefully in as part of a well-integrated a proper team, if you like. They'll all have had their own flu jabs, and the idea would still be that in the same way that if general practice gets busy, traditionally it just works harder, you know. And I don't think that would change even with a change in workforce that was less as a proportion was less GPs. So I have the utmost confidence that wider primary care team would still muck in and still make sure that it met periods of high demand, such as flu pandemics that you mentioned. What was the first question again? Sorry, it was
bank holidays.
So what we've not touched on, actually, is that we have extended GP hours services. We have four satellite hubs that work every evening from 6 until 10 and work every Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. till 6 p.m. Now, they provide booked GP appointments. And again, so although that service needs to be continued in some way and included in this in the changes, we have to have that. It came along a few years ago as one of those big government asks that we had to have it. We have that, and it provides a much bigger capacity for appointments with access to a GP or other members of a general practice team in the evenings and weekends than we ever had before with the old GP on call services. So there's a lot more GP appointments in the city available now in evenings and weekends, and that service runs on a bank holiday. So essentially, what that would mean is that if you're unwell on a bank holiday Monday and you ring 111, 111 can book you into one of those satellite hubs to be seen by a member of the general practice team, even on a bank holiday.
Right, thank you. We have now slightly run over time. I hope everybody, I know one person has asked the final question, but I hope I'm going to leave the question. But I hope everybody feels that the issues that are of concern to them have had an airing. I would really urge you to respond to our consultation. Obviously, we're going to take into account hugely the issues that we've discussed today. But it would also be helpful, if you still feel strongly about some issues, to write in. We genuinely want to hear. I appreciate there may be some cynicism to that, but we genuinely do want to